Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Wages of Rebellion by Chris Hedges, performed by David DeVries.
Introduction. We live in a revolutionary moment. The disastrous economic and political experiment that attempted to organize human behavior around the dictates of the global marketplace has failed. The promised prosperity that was to have raised the living standards of workers through trickle-down economics has been exposed as a lie. A tiny global oligarchy has amassed obscene wealth, while the engine of unfettered corporate capitalism plunders resources, exploits cheap, unorganized labor, and creates pliable, corrupt governments that abandon the common good to serve corporate profit. The relentless drive by the fossil fuel industry for profits is destroying the ecosystem, threatening the viability of the human species. And no mechanisms to institute genuine reform or halt the corporate assault are left within the structures of power, which have surrendered to corporate control. The citizen has become irrelevant. He or she can participate in heavily choreographed elections, but the demands of corporations and banks are paramount. History has amply demonstrated that the seizure of power by a tiny cabal, whether a political party or a clique of oligarchs, leads to despotism. Governments that cater exclusively to a narrow interest group and redirect the machinery of state to furthering the interests of that interest group are no longer capable of responding rationally in times of crisis. Blindly serving their masters, they acquiesce to the looting of state treasuries to bail out corrupt financial houses and banks while ignoring chronic unemployment and underemployment, along with stagnant or declining wages, crippling debt peonage, a collapsing infrastructure, and the millions left destitute and often homeless by deceptive mortgages and foreclosures. A bankrupt liberal class, holding up values it does nothing to defend, discredits itself as well as the purported liberal values of a civil democracy as it is swept aside along with those values. In this moment, a political, economic, or natural disaster, in short, a crisis, will ignite unrest, lead to instability, and see the state carry out draconian forms of repression to maintain order. This is what lies ahead. The historian Crane Brinton, in his 1965 book The Anatomy of Revolution, explores the preconditions for revolution in the English, French, American, and Russian revolutions. He cites a discontent that affects nearly all social classes, including economic grievances, not in the form of economic distress, but rather a feeling on the part of some of the chief enterprising groups that their opportunities for getting on in this world are unduly limited by political arrangements. A sense of entrapment and despair combine with unfulfilled expectations to fuel the crisis. Brinton argues that a decaying power elite in a pre-revolutionary society exploits not only the populace, but also its own natural allies. Louis XIV, for example, frequently revoked his patents to new nobility and resold them. Corporations, in a modern twist on the same exploitation of those most inclined to support them, defraud shareholders and investors, especially the small investors in the middle class who make up the bulwark of a capitalist democracy. Brinton lists other preconditions for revolution, including a unified solidarity in opposition to a tiny discredited power elite, a refusal by the press, scholars, and intellectuals to continue to defend the actions of the ruling class, an inability of government to respond to the most basic needs of citizens, and a steady loss of will within the power elite to rule. The denial of opportunities to the sons and daughters of the professional class and the middle class galvanizes resistance. A crippling isolation soon leaves the power elite with neither allies nor outside support. Finally, the state is convulsed by a crisis, usually triggered by economic instability and often accompanied by military defeat, as was the case in Tsarist Russia, or a long and futile conflict, as is the case with our own wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It is at the moment of crisis that revolution begins. It is never the poor, however, who make revolutions, as understood by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, who disdained the revolutionary potential of the lumpen proletariat. Marx and Engels correctly saw the lumpen proletariat as providing the primary fodder for the goons, militias, and thugs employed by a discredited regime to hold on to power through violence. The dangerous class, the social scum, lumpen proletariat, that passively rotting mass thrown off by the lowest layers of old society, may here and there be swept into the movement by a proletarian revolution. Its conditions of life, however, prepare it more for the part of a bribed tool of reactionary intrigue. This is a key factor in understanding the precursors for revolt. The idea that the very oppressed and poor are important as initiating and maintaining revolutions is a bourgeois one, Brinton writes. He adds another important caveat. No government has ever fallen before attackers until it has lost control over its armed forces or lost the ability to use them effectively, or, of course, lost such control of force because of interference by a more powerful foreign force, as in Hungary in 1849 or in 1956, and conversely, that no revolutionists have ever succeeded until they have got a predominance of effective armed force on their side. This holds true from spears and arrows to machine guns and gas, from Hippias to Castro. While violence and terrorism are often part of revolutions, the fundamental tool of any successful revolt is the nonviolent conversion of the forces deployed to restore order to the side of the rebels. Most successful revolutions are for this reason fundamentally nonviolent. The Russian Revolution was victorious once the Cossacks refused to fire on the protesters in Petrograd in 1917 and joined the crowds. The clerics who overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979 won once the Shah's military abandoned the collapsing regime. And the harsh communist regimes in Eastern Europe were doomed in 1989 when the security forces no longer defended them. The superior force of despotic regimes is disarmed not through violence, but through conversion. James Davies, in his essay Toward a Theory of Revolution, names the intolerable gap between what people want and what they get as the most important component of revolt. The rapidly widening gap between expectations and gratifications portends revolution, writes Davies. The most common case for this widening gap of individual dissatisfactions is economic or social dislocation that makes the affected individual generally tense, generally frustrated. That is, the greatest portion of people who join a revolution are preoccupied with tensions related to the failure to gratify the physical, economic needs and the needs of stable interpersonal, social relationships. However, like Marx, Engels, and Brinton, Davies adds that socioeconomically deprived poor people are unlikely to make a successful rebellion, a revolution, by themselves. It is rather a disenfranchised middle class and alienated members of the ruling class who orchestrate and lead a revolt. Without the support of disaffected bourgeoisie, disaffected nobles, and disaffected intellectuals, the French Revolution might have been some kind of grand episodic upheaval, he notes. But it would not likely have amounted to the successful assault on the political power structure that a revolution amounts to. The same can be said for the American Revolution. Those who signed the Declaration of Independence and/or became rulers of the new nation were gentlemen farmers like Washington and Jefferson, rather than callous-handed yeomen who became the rank and file of the Continental Army. The Russian Revolution, particularly in its 1905 phase, depended on the disaffection not solely of factory workers and peasants, but also of urban bourgeoisie, and almost incredibly, it seemed at first glance, of substantial numbers of the landed nobility. Brinton and Davies argue that expectations have usually been most frustrated, especially when coupled with economic depression and increased repression, immediately after periods when the standard of living rose and the political space opened. This is what took place in Russia, for example, in the latter half of the 19th century. Alexander II emancipated the serfs in 1861, began the process of industrialization, and created a state-administered legal system that attempted to wrest absolute authority from the noblemen and landowners, who had been imposing jail terms and punishment by fiat. The urban population nearly doubled between 1878 and 1897. Strikes, union organizing, workers' associations, and emergent political groups, along with a dissident press, gave hope for the future. Wages rose. The estimated annual net income at the end of the 19th century for a peasant family of five was 82 rubles. A factory worker could make 168 rubles. The process of reform ended when Alexander II was assassinated on March 13, 1881. Alexander III and his successor, Nicholas II, attempted to return the country to a rigid autocracy. Repression mounted, and the opening provided to a free press ended, especially in 1907, with the reinstatement of censorship and the banning of publications. Executions for offending the Tsar mounted. There were 26 death sentences during the 13 years of Alexander III's reign, 1881 to 1894, and 4,449 between 1905 and 1910, just 6 years of the reign of his grandson, Nicholas II. This 56-year period, from the freeing of the serfs in 1861 to the Russian Revolution in 1917, appears to constitute a single long phase in which popular gratification at the termination of one institution, serfdom, rather quickly was replaced with rising expectations which resulted from intensified industrialization and which were incompatible with the continuation of the inequitable and capricious power structure of Tsarist society, Davies notes. The expectations for political and economic improvement were further stymied when the country entered World War I. The poorly equipped Russian army suffered catastrophic defeats and massive loss of life. The economy broke down. By 1916, inflation had made food difficult to afford, and famine gripped parts of the country. But more than deprivation itself, Davies and Brinton highlight, it was the cycle of heightened expectations, economic improvement, and then frustrated hopes that led to revolt. In reality, the mere existence of privations is not enough to cause an insurrection. If it were, the masses would always be in revolt, Leon Trotsky noted. Today, this key component of revolution, the gap between what people want and indeed expect and what they get, is being played out in the United States and many states in Europe during a new age of mounting scarcity, declining wages, joblessness, government-imposed austerity measures, and assaults on civil liberties. The rising living standards experienced by the American working class in the 1950s have been in precipitous decline since the 1970s. The real earnings of the median male have declined by 19% since 1970, and the median male with only a high school diploma saw his real earnings fall by 41% from 1970 to 2010. Moreover, the memory of the post-war moment of prosperity and the belief that prosperity should still be possible, along with a revocation of protections under the Constitution that most Americans want restored, have left Americans increasingly alienated, frustrated, and angry. They have experienced the diminished expectations highlighted by Davies and Brinton. They have set those expectations against the bleakness of the present. Politicians, a moribund labor movement, and the mass media, either cowed or in the service of corporate power, assure the population that the old prosperity is still attainable, but via a different route. Prosperity will no longer come from expanding the manufacturing base, which characterized the very real prosperity of working men and women immediately after World War II. The neoliberal version of the promise of rising living standards is based on the fallacy of economic deregulation and financialization. Let us be rich, the elite say, and you will share in the spoils. All you have to do is work hard, obey the rules, and believe in yourself. This myth is disseminated across the political spectrum. It is the essential message peddled by everyone, from Oprah and the entertainment industry to the Christian right and positive psychologists. But this promise, as the masses of underemployed and unemployed are discovering, is a fiction. In this discovery, this understanding that workers will never have what they expect, lies revolutionary fodder. Today's economic stagnation, accompanied by a steady stripping away of civil liberties and the creation of a monstrous security and surveillance system of internal control, has followed the kind of roller coaster pattern of rising and then declining hopes that presages revolt, according to Brinton and Davies. The revolutionary ideal, the vision of a better world, the belief that resistance is a moral act to protect the weak and the poor, in short, an ideology, fuses with a sense of loss and betrayal engendered by a system that can no longer meet expectations. The revolts and revolutions that have convulsed the Arab world and the unrest in Greece and Spain share these vital characteristics. The primacy of corporate profit in a globalized economy has become universal. So have its consequences. Professor Rami Zuraic, who teaches agriculture and food sciences at the American University of Beirut, pointed out in The Guardian in 2011 that when international grain prices spiked in 2007 and 2008, Egypt's bread prices rose by 37%. 50% of the calories Egyptians consume, he wrote, come from outside the country. Moreover, Egypt, as the world's largest wheat importer, is hostage to world commodity prices, and he notes that only three corporations, Cargill, Archer Daniels Midland Company, and Bunge, all American, control 90% of the global grain trade. Zuraic argues that the rising price of food, especially bread, which puts a family's ability to feed itself in jeopardy, as happened during the French and Russian revolutions, was one of the major causes of the uprisings across the Arab world in 2010 and 2011. Should the global markets be unable to provide a country's need, or if there are not enough funds available to finance purchases and to offer price support, then the food of the poor will become inaccessible to them, Zuraic writes, adding, already in Egypt and Yemen, more than 40% of the population live below the poverty line and suffer from some form of malnutrition. Most of the poor in these countries have no access to social safety nets. Images of bread became central to the Egyptian protests, from young boys selling kaika, a breakfast bread, to one protester's improvised helmet made from bread loaves, taped to his head. Although the Arab revolutions were united under the slogan, "The people want to bring down the regime," not "The people want more bread," food was a catalyst. The contraction of the Greek economy by 20% in the last 5 years resulted in an unemployment rate of more than 27%. An estimated 10% of Greek children arrive at school underfed, hungry, or malnourished. Dr. Athena Linos, a professor at the University of Athens Medical School, who also heads a food assistance program at Prolepsis, a non-governmental public health group, told the New York Times, "When it comes to food insecurity, Greece has now fallen to the level of some African countries." The poor population in the United States, 15% of the total population, and a disturbing 21.8% for children under the age of 18, is expanding. The 46.5 million people living in poverty in 2012 was the largest number of poor counted during the 54 years in which the decennial census has calculated poverty rates. The weighted average poverty threshold for a household of four was an annual income of $23,492. That is well below what many economists believe constitutes a realistic poverty rate. And among those classified as poor, 20.4 million people lived in what was categorized as deep poverty, meaning that their incomes were 50% below the official poverty line. One quarter of the nation's Hispanic population, 13.6 million people, and 27.2% of African Americans, 10.9 million people, lived in poverty. There are 73.7 million children in the United States, and they represent 23.7% of the total population. Yet in 2012, they made up 34.6% of Americans living in poverty and 35% of those living in deep poverty. Climate change will only exacerbate these conditions. As pointed out by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, climate change will cause a decline in crop production and food prices will soar. Poverty and hunger have already begun to expand in the developing world and parts of the industrialized world. The realization that our expectations for a better future have been obliterated, not only for ourselves, but more importantly for our children, starts the chain reaction. There is a loss of faith in established systems of power. There is a weakening among the elites of the will to rule. Government becomes despised. Rage looks for outlets. The nation goes into crisis. Vladimir Lenin identified the components that come together to foster a successful revolt. The fundamental law of revolution, which has been confirmed by all revolutions, and particularly by all three Russian revolutions in the 20th century, is as follows. It is not enough for revolution that the exploited and oppressed masses should understand the impossibility of living in the old way and demand changes. What is required for revolution is that the exploiters should not be able to live and rule in the old way. Only when the lower classes do not want the old way, and when the upper classes cannot carry on in the old way, only then can revolution win. I have covered, as a foreign correspondent, revolts, insurgencies, and revolutions, including the guerrilla conflicts in the 1980s in Central America, the civil wars in Algeria, the Sudan, and Yemen, the two Palestinian uprisings, or intifadas, the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania, and the war in the former Yugoslavia. I have seen that despotic regimes in the final stages collapse internally. Once the foot soldiers of the elite, the police, the courts, the civil servants, the press, the intellectual class, and finally the army, no longer have the will to defend the regime is finished. When these state organs are ordered to carry out acts of repression, such as clearing people from parks and arresting or even shooting demonstrators, and refuse their orders, the old regime crumbles. The veneer of power appears untouched before a revolution, but the internal rot, unseen by the outside world, steadily hollows out the edifice state. And when dying regimes collapse, they do so with dizzying speed. When the aging East German dictator Erich Honecker, who had been in power for 13 years, was unable to get paratroopers to fire on protesting crowds in Leipzig in the fall of 1989, the regime was finished. He lasted another week in power. The same refusal to employ violence doomed the communist governments in Prague and Bucharest. In Romania, the army general on whom the dictator Nicolae Ceausescu had depended to crush protests was the general who condemned him to death in a hasty show trial on Christmas Day. Tunisia's Ben Ali and Egypt's Hosni Mubarak also lost power once they could no longer count on the security forces and the military to fire into crowds. Historians and political philosophers have often described these episodic revolutionary moments in human history, which are not confined by national borders, as waves. Walter Benjamin, in his essay about Goethe's novel Elective Affinities, makes the same point. The novel is about the decay of institutions, in this case marriage, and the forces that are unleashed when institutions, and most importantly the ideas and rituals that sustain them, lose their hold over the imagination. In these moments, Benjamin argues, the mythic and the ideas of the visionary cause people to abandon established mores and traditions to revolt. Benjamin noted that the role of the critic, like that of the rebel, is to steer the reader, or the population, toward the mysterious forces embodied in great art, or in revolutionary visions. Language restricts both art and the possibilities of recreating human society. In these moments, it matters more what is felt, Benjamin understood, than what is said. Immanuel Kant made much the same distinction between transcendental and critical forces in human existence. Once the transcendental is liberated through the decay of institutions, it harnesses a mythic power or vision that can inspire people to tear down the decayed structures that confine them. Revolt by the populace in one nation, inspired by these transcendental forces, inspires revolt in another nation. The important point that Benjamin and Kant make is that revolutions, whether in art or in society, are about emotion. These moments engender not simply new ideas, but new feelings about established power and human possibilities. The past few years, particularly since 2011, have witnessed popular uprisings exploding in waves around the world. In the Arab world, protests overthrew in quick succession the governments in Tunisia and Egypt and convulsed Morocco, Yemen, and Bahrain. Massive street protests have rattled Turkey, Greece, Portugal, Spain, the Ukraine, Georgia, and the United States. Movements feed off of other movements. The uprisings of the Arab Spring and the Portuguese and Spanish indignants in the Iberian Peninsula morphed into Occupy encampments in the United States. Revolutionary movements, nourished by radical new ideas and the collapse of bankrupt ruling ideologies, have throughout history spread in waves like these across the globe. The American Revolution of 1776 was an inspiration to the French Revolution in 1789. The French Revolution inspired the Haitian Revolution in 1791, the only successful slave revolt in human history, as well as a series of revolts in Europe from the Batavian Revolution in 1795 to the 1798 uprising in Ireland. The wave of revolt also swept over Latin America in the Wars for Independence from 1810 to 1826, led by revolutionaries such as José de San Martín and Simón Bolívar. In 1848, there was another outbreak of revolutionary fever. It first spiked in the Sicilian capital of Palermo before raging throughout Italy and Europe. The uprisings in Paris in February 1848 ended the Orléans monarchy and led to the creation of the French Second Republic. Civil war broke out in Germany, Denmark, which saw the end to its absolute monarchy, Austria, and Hungary, which abolished serfdom. The 1848 revolt in Hungary led to the resignation of Clemens von Metternich, the Austrian prince and foreign minister, and forced Emperor Ferdinand to grant Hungary a constitution, an elected parliament, and the end of censorship. Polish rebels, although unsuccessful, rose up against their Prussian masters. Ireland also saw a failed uprising. Chartism, a working-class movement that from 1838 to 1858 organized millions of laborers to demand political reform and suffrage, arose as a powerful force in Britain and influenced Engels, although it was not a socialist or communist movement. Revolutionists who took part in uprisings in one part of the globe would often migrate to take part in uprisings in another. Francisco de Miranda, the Venezuelan radical who launched his country's wars of liberation from Spain, went to the United States to meet with revolutionaries such as Thomas Paine, and he participated in the French Revolution. Paine fomented revolt in the United States, England, and revolutionary France, where he was initially embraced as a hero. Giuseppe Garibaldi fought in Brazil and Uruguay before he returned to Italy in 1848 to play a central role in uprisings in Milan and Rome, and a few years later in the Risorgimento. The great European theorists of revolution, including Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, who published the Communist Manifesto in 1848, participated in the revolutionary wave. With his radical views, Marx was denied an academic career despite his brilliance as a scholar. He began writing for the radical journal Rheinische Zeitung and soon became the journal's editor. The journal was shut down in 1843 by the Prussian authorities. Marx moved to Paris, the epicenter of 19th-century radicalism. France had spawned Henri de Saint-Simon and Charles Fourier, the fathers of modern socialism, who argued that the state and industry should be subjugated to the common good. Between 1843 and 1850, against the backdrop of worldwide political and economic upheaval and his personal experiences with state persecution, Marx formulated his most important ideas on communism. He returned to Germany with Engels for the uprising of 1848 and started another radical newspaper, Neue Rheinische Zeitung. During the year he spent in Germany, Marx functioned as a revolutionist attempting to organize an insurrection in Germany modeled on the French Revolution. His paper was eventually banned, and he was expelled from Prussia. He fled to Paris, but was forced by the Cavaignac government to leave that city in 1849. Moving on to London, Marx found his famous refuge in the reading room of the British Museum. The anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, who, like Marx, was in Germany during the Revolution of 1848, was what the historian Adam Ulam calls a visiting revolutionary. There was no insurrection, actual or planned, Prague in 1848, Dresden in 1849, Poland in 1863, the numerous attempted revolts in France and Italy, in which he was not ready to fight, lend his assistance as a drafter of manifestos, theorist of revolutionary dictatorship, and the like, Ulam writes. Bakunin, as Ulam points out, never worked out a systematic philosophy of revolution or of socialism. His socialism was mostly of a visceral type, the revolt against any kind of oppression and injustice, rejection of any palliatives or halfway measures. But Bakunin, however inchoate his own ideas were about the new society, was at the same time remarkably prescient about Marxism. He warned that it would lead to a centralized and oppressive state. He foresaw what would happen to workers once their self-identified representatives in the revolutionary vanguard took power. Those previous workers, having just become rulers or representatives of the people, will cease being workers. They will look at the workers from their heights. They will represent not the people, but themselves. He who doubts it does not know human nature. Bakunin grew to hate Marx and Marxism. But he never offered much in the way of a concrete vision to replace the capitalist state he sought to destroy. The Russian anarchist Alexander Herzen, although he did not embrace Bakunin's lusty calls for action, violence, and sometimes terrorism, also detested Marx. But Herzen, like Bakunin, offered little more than hazy notions of volunteerism and autonomous collectives and communes to replace the state. The anarchists proved more adept at understanding autocratic power and challenging it than at constructing a governing system to replace it. The remarkable French revolutionary Louis-Auguste Blanqui, like Bakunin, took part in a series of French revolts, including an attempted armed insurrection in France in May 1839, the 1848 uprising, and the Paris Commune, a socialist uprising that seized control of France's capital from March 18 until May 28 in 1871. Workers in cities such as Marseille and Lyon attempted to organize similar communes before the Paris Commune was militarily crushed. Blanqui is an important, if neglected, 19th-century theorist, for unlike nearly all of his contemporaries, he dismissed the naive belief, central to Marx, that human history is a linear progression toward equality and greater morality. He warned that this absurd positivism is the lie perpetrated by oppressors. All atrocities of the victor, the long series of his attacks, are coldly transformed into constant, inevitable evolution, like that of nature. But the sequence of human things is not inevitable, like that of the universe. It can be changed at any moment. He also foresaw that scientific and technological advancement, rather than a harbinger of progress, could be a terrible weapon in the hands of capital against work and thought. He even decried the despoiling of the natural world. The axe fells, nobody replants. There is no concern for the future's ill health. Humanity, he wrote, is never stationary. It advances or goes backwards. Its progressive march leads it to equality. Its regressive march goes back through every stage of privilege to human slavery, the final word of the right to property. Further, I am not amongst those who claim that progress can be taken for granted, that humanity cannot go backwards. His understanding that history can usher in long periods of repression as well as freedom and liberty is worth remembering. It was Blanqui who first used the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat. Blanqui's call for a small conspiratorial group to seize power in the name of the working class was a tactic that would be successfully employed by Lenin, who then set out to dismantle the autonomous Soviets and workers' committees. Lenin, with a handful of subordinates, carried out what became, in essence, a right-wing counter-revolution that introduced a system of repressive, centralized state capitalism and state terror. Marx never embraced Blanqui's or Lenin's call for a small group of disciplined revolutionaries to seize power. Marx hoped that a broad-based mass movement of industrial workers like the Chartists would organize to overthrow the capitalist order and usher in communism. The question of how to carry out a successful revolution, which occupied much of Lenin's thought, brings with it the question of whether the ruthless tactics and a small, disciplined class of professional revolutionaries that make a revolution possible make an open society impossible. Any revolution, once begun, carries the potential for fanaticism. Revolutionaries in power can erect, in the name of a glorious utopian ideal, a system of state terror, as demonstrated by the Leninists and Stalinists, the ideological heirs of the French Jacobins. The next great revolutionary wave swept Russia in 1905 with its humiliating defeat by Japan. The defeat triggered the abortive uprising against the Tsar, the dress rehearsal for the 1917 Russian Revolution, and ignited another round of revolutionary upheavals around the world. The Argentine Revolution of 1905 was followed by the Persian Constitutional Revolution, which took place between 1905 and 1907 and overthrew the monarchy, establishing a free press, competing political parties, and a parliament. The Young Turk Revolution in 1908 reversed the 1878 suspension of the Ottoman Parliament, the General Assembly, by Sultan Abdulhamid II, and inaugurated the Second Constitutional Era. These uprisings were followed in 1910 by revolutions in Portugal and Mexico, and by the 1911 Chinese Xinhai Revolution, which overthrew the Qing Dynasty and established the Republic of China. The February Russian Revolution in 1917 forced the Tsar to abdicate and, after an armed putsch led by Lenin in October, brought the Bolsheviks to power. The Russian Revolution inspired socialist uprisings in Germany, Italy, and Hungary, indeed in most of Europe, and fueled the imagination of radical movements in the United States, as well as the Indian independence movement led by Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi. It was the Russian Revolution's catalyzing of the radical wing of the trade union movement that led to the formation of the first Communist Party in the United States and triggered the Red Scare hysteria, which allowed the state to carry out a preemptive war against radical and populist movements. Unions such as the Industrial Workers of the World, or the Wobblies, were destroyed. Publications such as The Masses and Appeal to Reason were banned. The socialist leader, Eugene V. Debs, was imprisoned in 1918. Emma Goldman, along with more than 200 other radical aliens, was stripped of her passport and deported in 1919 to Russia. Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were executed in 1927. By the 1920s, a once powerful and radical labor movement in the United States had been broken. Although it was revived with the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s, it would be crushed again by World War II and the anti-communist hysteria that followed. The establishment of what would become the Federal Bureau of Investigation in 1908, led from 1924 until 1972 by J. Edgar Hoover, was a direct response to the revolutionary wave that gripped the American working class. FBI agents, often little more than state-employed goons and thugs, ruthlessly hunted down those on the left. The FBI spied on and infiltrated labor unions, political parties, radical groups, especially those led by African Americans, anti-war groups, and later the civil rights movement, in order to discredit anyone, including politicians such as Henry Wallace, who questioned the power of the state and big business. Agents burglarized homes and offices. They illegally opened mail and planted unlawful wiretaps, created blacklists, and demanded loyalty oaths. They destroyed careers and sometimes lives. By the time they were done, America's progressive and radical movements, which had given the country the middle class and opened up our political system, did not exist. It was upon the corpses of these radical movements, which had fought for the working class, that the corporate state was erected in the late 20th century. The great wave of revolution that took place in 1989 with the collapse of the Soviet Union was the last revolutionary wave before the Arab uprisings in 2010. 14 Soviet republics in 1989 broke away to form independent states: Albania, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Poland, Bulgaria, East Germany, Yugoslavia, Cambodia, Ethiopia, Somalia, the Congo-Brazzaville, Angola, Mozambique, Benin, Mongolia, and South Yemen all replaced their communist governments. As a foreign correspondent, I witnessed the swift disintegration of the communist regimes in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. In all of these countries, a significant portion of the population had abandoned their faith in the ideological constructs of power, just as previous generations had abandoned the belief in the divine right of kings. These populations turned against a corrupt ruling elite. They lost hope for a better future, unless those in power were replaced. And they seized in a revolutionary moment upon an ideal, one that was often more emotional than intellectual, that allowed them to defy established power. This revolutionary sentiment, as much a mood as an idea, is again on the march. In a 2011 New York Times article titled, "As Scorn for Vote Grows, Protests Surge Around the Globe," Nicholas Kulish made this point. Their complaints range from corruption to lack of affordable housing and joblessness, common grievances the world over. But from South Asia to the heartland of Europe, and now even to Wall Street, these protesters share something else: wariness, even contempt toward traditional politicians and the democratic political process they preside over. They are taking to the streets in part because they have little faith in the ballot box. Whether an uprising will come in time to save us from the effects of climate change, which some experts say has already passed a point of no return, or whether it will be crushed by internal systems of security, is unknown. It is worth remembering Blanqui's warnings that human history can be a march to totalitarianism as well as to liberty. Since the uprisings in Tahrir Square in 2011, the Egyptian military has instituted a brutal counter-revolution. The Occupy encampments in the United States were cleared by force in cities across the country. The pervasive security and surveillance state, which makes us the most watched, spied, and eavesdropped upon, monitored, photographed, and controlled population in human history, is being employed against all who rebel. In three previous books, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle, Death of the Liberal Class, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, I examined a cultural, political, and economic system in terminal decline. I chronicled the rise of totalitarian corporate power, or what the political philosopher Sheldon Wolin in Democracy Incorporated calls inverted totalitarianism. Inverted totalitarianism, which does not find its expression through a demagogue or charismatic leader, represents the political coming of age of corporate power and the political demobilization of the citizenry, he writes. It is a dispersed, faceless power, the rule of nobody, as Hannah Arendt wrote, that is expressed in the blank, terrifying anonymity of the corporate state. Unlike classical totalitarian movements, the corporate forces behind inverted totalitarianism do not boast of replacing decaying structures with a new revolutionary structure. They purport to honor electoral politics, freedom of speech, the right to assembly, and the Constitution. But they so corrupt and manipulate the levers of power internally that democracy is extinguished. The Constitution remains in place, but has been so radically reinterpreted by the courts and by the executive and legislative branches of government, all serving corporate power, as to be essentially nullified. Inverted totalitarianism, Wolin writes, is not expressly conceptualized as an ideology or objectified in public policy. Typically, it is furthered by power holders and citizens who often seem unaware of the deeper consequences of their actions or inactions. But inverted totalitarianism is as dangerous as classical forms of totalitarianism. Corporate totalitarianism, for me, is interchangeable with inverted totalitarianism, as Wolin uses that term throughout his book. I argued in my previous three books that change will only come from mass movements and large-scale acts of civil disobedience. Wages of Rebellion examines another aspect of revolt. Exploring the forces and personalities that foster rebellion, it looks at the personal cost of rebellion, what it takes emotionally, psychologically, and physically to defy absolute power. Rebels share much in common with religious mystics. They hold fast to a vision that often they alone can see. They view rebellion as a moral imperative, even as they concede that the hope of success is slim and at times impossible. Rebels, a number of whom I interviewed for this book, are men and women endowed with a peculiar obstinacy. Willing to accept deprivation and self-sacrifice, they are not overly concerned with defeat. They endure through a fierce independence and courage. Many, maybe most, have difficult and eccentric personalities. The best of them are driven by a profound empathy, even love, for the vulnerable, the persecuted, and the weak. Revolutions take time. They are often begun by one generation and completed by the next. Those who give the first check to a state are the first overwhelmed in its ruin, Michel de Montaigne wrote in 1580. The fruits of public commotion are seldom enjoyed by him who was the first mover. He only beats the water for another's net. Revolutions can be crushed by force, as amply demonstrated by history, or hijacked by individuals, such as Lenin, Trotsky, and later Joseph Stalin, or movements that betray the populace. Revolutions can even be faux revolutions when, through the careful manipulation of counter-revolutionary forces, they demand not reform, but the restoration of retrograde power elites. The Central Intelligence Agency has long been a master of this technique. It organized street demonstrations and protests in Iran in 1953 to overthrow Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh and his cabinet. It funded and stoked protests again in 1973 in Chile to prompt the Chilean military to overthrow President Salvador Allende. Seamus Milne raises this point in an article about the 2014 protests in Venezuela, featuring the subhead, "Street action is now regularly used with Western backing to target elected governments in the interests of elites." Milne writes, "The upsurge in global protest in the past couple of years has driven home the lesson that mass demonstrations can have entirely different social and political meanings. Just because they wear bandanas and build barricades and have genuine grievances doesn't automatically mean protesters are fighting for democracy or social justice. The closer one gets to the street during a revolution, the messier it becomes. Movements within the revolutionary body frequently compete for power, fight over arcane bits of doctrine, dispute tactics, form counterproductive schisms, misread power, and engage in self-defeating power struggles. The state uses its resources to infiltrate, monitor, vilify, and arrest or assassinate the movement leaders, and all uprisings, even supposedly leaderless ones, have leaders. When they are authentic, these movements express a fundamental truth about societies in decay that even those who cannot articulate it are often able to feel. This is the secret of their power. They offer new possibilities, a new language and vocabulary to those who are being abused by failed systems of governance. Once this truth is unleashed, once it can be expressed, it is very hard to silence." The Zapatista leader, Subcomandante Insurgente Marcos, in an interview with Gabriel Garcia Marquez in The Nation magazine, made this point. He pointed out that revolutions entail a new way of communicating. "In my family, words had a very special value," Marcos told the Colombian novelist. "The way we went out into the world was through language. We didn't learn to read in school, but by reading newspapers. My mother and father made us read books that rapidly permitted us to approach new things. Some way or another, we acquired a consciousness of language not as a way of communicating with each other, but as a way of building something, as if it were more of a pleasure than a duty or assignment. When the age of catacombs arrives, the word is not highly valued for the intellectual bourgeoisie. It is relegated to a secondary level. It's when we are in the indigenous communities that language is like a catapult. You realize that words fail to express certain things, and this obliges you to work on your language skills to go over and over words to arm and disarm them." There is nothing rational about rebellion. To rebel against insurmountable odds is an act of faith, without which the rebel is doomed. This faith is intrinsic to the rebel, the way caution and prudence are intrinsic to those who seek to fit into existing power structures. The rebel, possessed by inner demons and angels, is driven by a vision. I do not know if the new revolutionary wave and the rebels produced by it will succeed, but I do know that without these rebels, we are doomed.